Hello, fellow rebel capitalists. I hope you're well. I'm right here with my good buddy, Jeff Snyder, one of the smartest guys in the macroeconomic space. And he just did a blog post, I think just yesterday or the day prior, on this inversion in the yield curve with the euro dollar future market. And we always kind of focus on the yield curve of the bond market. And I believe that the big one there, Jeff, is the twos and the tens.
Is that in the bond market? To me, it's the fives and the tens. That's the middle part of the curve.
But if you're looking at, if you're watching like CNBC, what do they usually focus on?
Either the 2 year tenure or the 3 month tenure. So, okay. Yeah, they're kind of looking, and they're only looking for it, you know, if it inverts and things like that. I mean, the yield curve has a whole lot of information, and not just about inversion, flattening, steepening, all sorts of things.
Yeah, that they ignore. Okay, and then guys, I think Josh put a link in there. So Jeff and I are going to talk about his recent blog post. And then at the end, we're going to take some callers. So if you want to get in queue, did you put that link up there, Josh? Okay. So the first question I've got for you, Jeff, is the other day you did a video with Emil. And I know Van Meter was probably over at your house because he put some pictures of himself right behind you. That was one of the funniest things I've ever seen. Did you know that he did that?
I know nothing. I know nothing. I don't know anything about pictures or Steve or I had no idea that my pictures were such a big deal.
That was classic.
It was appropriate. If he got in my house somehow, why not put his pictures on my wall?
I saw that picture. I think I first saw it on Twitter. And oh my gosh, I almost fell out of my chair. I was laughing so hard. So that was awesome. See, you
he's
know, it's
gonna give me a heartache because he's using the term Bond King, and I always use Bond King as an epithet because you know Bill Gross or Jeffrey Gunn, like they're Bond kings that don't know anything about bonds. Now I'm not gonna be able to use the term anymore.
He's got to call himself the Bond Prince or something like that, you know.
Bond Emperor.
Yeah. All right, man. Let's fire into your post. We've got it here. There we go. Let's go to the top. So this is title. This is a big one. And no, this is not clickbait. So the first thing I've got highlighted here is yet they are among the most important because these derivative contracts have been the most reliable, especially early warning indications that exist. So do you want to expand on that? Jeff, I think you're talking about this euro dollar future curve, which I think is even a better predictive tool than maybe even the twos and the tens.
Yeah, the euro dollar futures are derivative contracts, and they're not just some tiny little niche market that only, you know, major players use once in a while. This is a massive market that maybe next to the U.S. Treasury market is probably the biggest, most sophisticated and deepest in the world. We're talking about trillions of dollars in notional contracts traded every day in these marketplaces and these euro dollar futures contracts. So even though most people probably have never heard of it or really don't know much about it, it is a huge internal piece of the global guts, the global plumbing, the marketplace, fixed income, bonds, credit, money, all those things coming together in Eurodollar futures. And Eurodollar futures are specifically a contract that is tied to, obviously, as the name, the derivative contract implies, it's a future bet on where 3 month LIBOR will be. So it's a money curve. It's about a money rate. And as most people maybe know, LIBOR is the euro dollar rate, which is why it's called euro dollar futures. So we're talking about offshore money, how it relates to, you know, interest rates in the short run, but interest rates in the short run now versus the future. And it leads us to draw these curves, which tells us a lot about what the monetary system itself is seeing and thinking about the monetary system that we can't otherwise observe directly.
Or the global economy.
Huge amount of information here that's available that pretty much nobody knows about.
So if I'm a bank in, let's say, Colombia, and I need a dollar-denominated loan, so I go to a bank, let's say, in the Cayman Islands, and I say, okay, I need a loan for $100 million. What type of interest rate will you give me? That bank in the Cayman Islands can create a dollar-denominated loan, but to get the interest rate, they'd first check with LIBOR. Is that correct? And then they'd charge them maybe a risk premium on top of that?
Yeah. And not only that, where Eurodollar futures really come in is that, okay, we're gonna do a short-term loan. You know, I'm the bank in the Cayman Islands. I'm going to lend you these funds that I'm going to create. But you're not just interested in what the interest rate you're going to be paying today is. you want to hedge yourself in case interest rates change, because you're not just going to be funding for a day or two. You're likely going to be rolling over funding over time. So you want to be hedged for changes in the interest rate market, because, you know, it's an uncertain world. And the last thing you want is to, hey, I'm paying X number, X percentage on my short-term funding today, but all of a sudden tomorrow it's X plus a lot. If you're not hedged, that could be a very, very bad day for you. So
you could lock that in with important. So you could lock that in with an interest rate swap. Correct me if I'm wrong. And then that future would be tied to what that Eurodollar futures curve is.
Essentially, you could lock it in with a swap, or you could just hedge with Eurodollar futures and various different strategies. There's different ways of looking at it. Plus, you could just look at the curve, Eurodollar futures curve yourself, and say, well, the market doesn't look like it's forecasting by way of interest rate volatility. So maybe I don't need to hedge at all. Okay. So you really just use this marketplace to tell you what is this huge money market, this huge, vast offshore global system. What is it thinking about in terms of long run, short run, potential risk, risk aversion, volatility, all these types of factors that you absolutely need to know as best as you possibly can, because by doing a short-term funding loan, as we're writing it out here, leads a lot of risk on the table. As we've seen since August of 2007, these funding markets can fall apart and become non-negotiable very quickly.
Right. Okay. So I think most people have got their head around it. Let's see. Let me just go over this last sentence here. It's absent an actual money aggregate that takes into account enough of those shadows. Yeah. So now we're talking about the dollars that are in the shadows that just does not get picked up by any M number period. And it's on the bank's balance sheets, or it's just out of the purview of the Fed, really. And yeah, so what you're saying is
footnote dollars. They're just sitting, they're not even on bank statements. They're, stuff you can find in the footnotes. And that includes a lot of derivative contracts, like you were talking about before, like currency swaps.
Yeah, so that's a much better way to look at it. So it's kind of a footnote cash, but that stuff really adds up. In fact, there's probably more of those than there are dollars that are actually quantifiable.
Multiples, not just more. Yeah. There's multiples.
Yeah. So what you're saying is, by looking at this curve, that can tell us maybe what is going to happen in the future to the amount of money that is actually in the system, when you not only include what we can quantify, but also include what we cannot quantify.
Yeah, and I think that's the major point that we're making here, and not just about Eurodollar futures, but all of these markets comprehensively sending a signal from the inside that we can't directly observe by the people who are trading on the inside of this monetary system. They're telling us what's going on by giving us these market signals, these prices and these curves that we can then interpret pretty succinctly and very presciently about what we should expect in the near term and how it evolves into the future.
Okay, so at the next highlighted bit I have here, I think it kind of references another one of your articles, but then it goes over how, LIBOR is, to a certain degree, maybe it's direct or just implicit or just maybe through psychology, but it's kind of a derivative of IOER and reverse repo, where the Fed's the counterparty in the transaction. And that's how the Fed kind of manages their target rate, and then LIBOR is an extension of that.
They're related because you're in these money markets, these offshore money markets that flow onshore back again. You're going to be influenced by the Fed, because if the Fed pays IOER at X and you can get IOER, then that's going to influence whether or not you're going to lend at LIBOR, because LIBOR may be related to maybe an alternative or the reverse repo or something like that. So the Fed can use its policy rates to influence global money markets, which is sort of the point the Fed's trying to make. And so 3-month LIBOR is influenced, and really before August of 2007, they were tied together very, very, very tightly. But even now, there's still a very good and high correlation between 3-month LIBOR, especially over the intermediate term, with the Federal Reserve's policy rates like IOER, the Fed funds range, and the reverse repo.
So if the Fed raises the Fed funds, then most likely the front end of that euro dollar curve goes up as well. But if the back end or the long end doesn't go up because the banks are seeing less economic activity in the future, then that could give us that inversion.
That's where it gets interesting. You're exactly right. There's really, it's almost like there are two curves together that come together. And the yield curve is very much the same way. The front end of the euro dollar futures curve what are called the whites and the reds, which are the first two packs, the first two yearly, you know, four quarterly bundles put together. What they're really, you know, what's going on in these markets is that these huge credit, debts, mortgages, all the fixed income stuff that goes into the financial sausage around the world, you know, they're trying to hedge their exposures to funding costs. So they're looking at these markets and saying, what is the biggest influence in the short run? Well, the biggest influence in the short run, which is the whites and the reds, are the Federal Reserve. If the Federal Reserve says it's going to hike rates, chances are it's going to probably hike rates. And so the first couple years of contracts, looking forward a couple years, the whites and the reds are highly influenced by what the Fed says it's going to do.
So that would be like the equivalent of the T-bills, right? Like just the short end of the bond market or the bond curve.
Yeah, we're looking more specifically at money funding and money markets here. So it's really influenced by what the Fed says it's going to do. And if the Fed says it's going to raise rates, then what you'll see in Eurodollar futures, especially the front end, these whites and these reds, the first eight quarterly contracts on the curve,
yeah,
they're going to be steep because they're going to reflect, hey, Jay Powell says we're going to start raising rates. And so those eight contracts are going to reflect rising interest rates.
Yes.
Now it gets very different. It gets very interesting beyond the whites and the reds when you get into the greens and the blues.
Okay, so
the third and fourth year.
Okay, so let's take a time out there for a second. Just again, the whites and the reds, guys. That's just basically the front end of this yield of this euro dollar futures yield curve. So just envision the front end of the bond market yield curve. You know, is maybe T-bills. So going out to like you know, a year in maturity. So that's kind of when Jeff is saying the whites and the reds, that's what he's referring to. And then the next step, which I think is the green and the blues, Jeff?
Yeah, the greens and the blues.
That would be
just maybe to be more specific, right now, the white pack would be the December 2021 contract, which is the next one in line, along with the March, June, and September of 2022. Those are the whites currently. Remember, everything rolls as we move forward, but right now, those are the whites. And then the reds would be the next four in line, starting with December 2022,
right,
also including March, June, and September of 2023.
So then the greens and the blues would be indicative of something further out this yield curve, which would be like going out the bond market yield curve to the 5-year, 10-year, 30-year.
Exactly. So we get to the greens, which are, you know, now December 2023 and forward. That's where, like the U.S. Treasury curve, it stops being influenced mostly by the Federal Reserve. Right. And the market starts pricing economic reality or the implications of what's happening today and how that will play out or how the market thinks it's likely to play out over time. Mm-hmm. So you've got the whites and the reds, the front part of the Eurodollar futures curve that reflect what the Fed says it's going to do. And then you've got the greens and the blues and the golds and the purple further down the curve, which are what is the Fed going to be able to do? Because we think the world actually looks like this. And it may be very different from what the Fed says today. The Fed says it's going to hike rates, but if the market doesn't believe it's going to be able to hike rates for very long or at all, then you'll see two different types of curves develop. You'll see the steepness in the whites and the reds, the front part, reflecting what the Fed says. But then you get to the greens and the blues, and the curve could look vastly different because the market's saying, we're seeing some negative signs here. And it may take the Fed a long time to figure this out because it always takes the Fed a long time to figure out reality. But at some point, what we're seeing that's negative today is likely to have a serious effect. And so this is where we get into inversion, because in the greens and the blues that are more reflective of you know, bets on reality down the road, it may be very different from what Jay Powell says, like in 2018. So we see almost two separate curves at the same time, which is where this inversion actually comes from.
Okay, so I think we just touched on this next highlighted part that I wanted to discuss. Let's see, we touched on that. Yep, now we keep going here. Now you're talking about what a healthy yield curve would look like if we were truly going into an economic recovery. So that's sound, and you know, from a fundamental standpoint, it's sustainable. So let's talk about this, and then we'll try to connect how this applies to inflation or maybe economic growth, or excuse me, economic output or global economic activity.
Yeah, the curve should be upward sloping, and it's doubly upward sloping from where we are today, which is at an incredibly historically low interest rate. So we should be looking for a, you know, don't fear higher interest rates. Higher interest rates are good. Higher interest rates are a good sign. It means that we're moving our way back toward normality or normalcy. Normalcy means interest rates normalize, which is not low interest rates. So we should be looking at a curve, Eurodollar futures, as well as the yield curve, that is not just upward sloping, but steeply upward sloping, and not just in the whites and the reds, but also the greens and the blues and the golds and the purples and all the way down the curve. That would mean the market says, yes, not only is Jay Powell looking at rate hikes, we're also looking at rate hikes to continue far into the future, unbroken, unstoppable, you know, continuous for the foreseeable future, because we think, the market thinks, that the economic and monetary situation is healthy. It's good. We're on our way back to recovery and normal. So a steep upward sloping yield curve is a thing of beauty. That's what we want to see. That's what we want to see. You know, that's what we've been waiting to see since, you know, really 2007. And it just hasn't happened because obviously the market keeps pricing in these interruptions to what are supposed to be best laid plans, but it never really works out that way. So upward sloping, good, beautiful, awesome. That's what we want.
Is there a way that the interest rates could go up at the long end and it be a result of something other than the market perceiving healthy economic growth in the future?
Are you talking about something like credit risk in the U.S. government? The federal government going too far and breaking things down? I suppose it's a possibility.
I'm trying to take it to an extreme in my own head. And I'm thinking, okay, if not that the U.S. is going to get there, but let's just take if they had this market in like Venezuela or something, you know, you're seeing prices skyrocket daily. Therefore, I'd assume that interest rates would be at a, you know, whatever, 10,000%. But yet we couldn't say that economic activity was increasing. Economic activity would be decreasing at the same time you had significant consumer price inflation. So
you're talking about the difference between nominal and real yields, essentially your nominal and real rates. And yeah, I don't know how the Eurodollar futures curve would actually price something like that, because I think right now what's going on, or what the market trades on, is not such distant way down the road possibilities. It's looking at the situation today as it exists and projecting the problems we have today into the future. What's likely to happen that we can see today that's likely to affect tomorrow? Yeah. And in the current shape of the curve and the current market, the way the market's trading, it's not about credit risk for the U.S. government. I'm not saying that's not a problem, that the U.S. government's fiscal deficits aren't an issue. They're not an issue right now. And they're not an issue that the market perceives as something we need to worry about right now, even though it might be something that we have to worry about in time. As the market is positioned right now, it's basically all about monetary conditions. It's liquidity risk, essentially.
I did a whiteboard video trying to explain this last night. And I kept coming to the conclusion in my own mind, because I had to divorce myself from thinking strictly about consumer price inflation as the definition of, as the only definition of inflation. And I'm thinking, okay. And I went back to the 40s, like, and I used that chart from an earlier post. And then I used a chart that Lynn has as well. And, you know, you see those big consumer price spikes, but that wasn't necessarily a result of monetary inflation. So then I in my own mind, I thought, it's a lot easier if I kind of replace the word inflation with economic activity. So although we might have price spikes as a result of supply shocks, we're not having an increase in economic activity. In fact, we can have a decrease in economic activity, very similar to what we saw in 2020, where we did see prices spike, but no one would argue that we had an increase in economic output. Is there something to that line of thinking?
Yeah, that's actually it. And you know, people give me crap all the time because I say it's not inflation, and I don't mean that consumer prices haven't changed or they haven't gone up by a lot. What I say when I use the term inflation, I mean money printing. There's excess money in the system. And what that means, the implication of it, is that consumer prices don't just go up today, they're going to go up tomorrow and the day after and the day after and the day after. So it's sustained consumer price acceleration that is inflation. And the situation you're talking about, where consumer prices are forced higher through a bottleneck in supply, as we've seen over the last year, you're right. It's not actually an increase in activity at all. In fact, it's amazing when you adjust for prices, things like global trade, exports and imports and things like that, there's actually less trade. There's actually less production now than there was a couple years ago. So you're absolutely right. Yeah. It's not more activity. It's actually less activity.
Right. So when we're looking at the bond market, and this is a discussion that we had a few months ago, you know, it's not just the U.S. Treasury market telling us there's going to be less economic activity in the United States, but maybe more so globally. That's what we have to remember, that this is a global market. It doesn't necessarily say, hey, this is what's going to happen with the United States, although that could be a part of it.
Yeah, and you would expect eventually the United States wouldn't be isolated. There is no decoupling from the global Eurodollar system. It's really about, you know, variations in time when all these things line up. But you're right. We're looking, even U.S. Treasuries, even Eurodollar futures, we're looking about the situation or the prospective situation in the global economy, in the global system. So
yeah,
we got to think more than local here. We got to think globally.
Yeah. So, okay, my next question would be, we talk about an increase in the money supply. We'll just use that. We'll call it dollar supply, using M2 and the money that's in the shadow, or the dollars that are in the shadows. Is it safe to assume that if we do have economic activity increasing, that we would also see a corresponding increase in the overall money supply in aggregate total?
That's if you're talking about broader shadow money terms, that's usually kind of the correlation we see.
Okay.
When we find the bond market, for example, reflecting higher growth and inflation expectations as a steeper yield curve with higher nominal rates, especially at the long end, that's associated with higher growth and inflation, which is, you know, a less of a monetary constraint in the shadow system. So there is a correlation between economic activity, limited as it has been since 2008, and these very serious and very, you know, time-tested indications in the quote-unquote bond market, which includes all of these things, not just U.S. Treasuries, but other sovereign bond markets, as well as Eurodollar futures, currency swaps, interest rate swaps, even the price of the dollar's exchange value itself. We get a comprehensive picture of how the monetary system is doing, how it's expected, and what are the risks being perceived in those markets from all of these financial indications. And there is a definite relationship between the monetary condition and the ability of the global economy to at least stop contracting.
Yeah, so let's go back in history, because one of the charts that I used in that whiteboard video where I was trying to explain your position to the best of my ability and Lynn's position is I used that long-term chart of interest rates. I'm just thinking right off the top of my head here. And I think it peaked out in World War I, and then it pretty much went all the way down that cycle, went down in yields to 1946. And I think that's when it started to come back up. But then in the 1950s, that's when we got done with that yield curve control, which I think I agree with you. I don't think that really had anything to do with bond rates. And then we started to see a growth in the money supply in the 1950s. And that's when we started that upslope to where it peaked out in 79 or 80. So
82,
Is it safe to assume that from World
George,
War
I? George, just to interrupt, it's not an accident that you see the inflation, real monetary inflation, start where it did, which is in the second half of the 1950s. The Eurodollar system showed up in the mid-1950s, and then all of a sudden we've got bond yields as well as sustained CPI increases. Now, the first increase in the CPI late 50s wasn't the great inflation, obviously, but it was sort of a precursor of what was to come. And after a little bit about of disinflation in the early 1960s, you had bond yields spot on predicting the looming great inflation, which was the Eurodollar just being unleashed all over the world.
So basically what happened there, guys, is 1944 we had Bretton Woods, and the world says, okay, the United States, you're in charge of creating dollars not only inside the U.S. but outside the United States for these global economies to grow at full capacity. And the U.S. says, okay, we'll bear that responsibility. But then what happens is their trade deficit aren't big enough to export enough dollars, and therefore these banks in the early 1950s say to themselves, okay, we need to figure out a solution. So if the U.S. isn't going to export enough dollars, we'll just go ahead and create the dollars ourselves and lend them out. And that's where you get the euro dollar system. And that's where you get an increase in the actual money supply that was picked up by the long end of the yield curve. And that takes us into the inflation of the 60s and the 70s.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it was the world's first ledger money virtual electronic currency. Because as you just stated, it's, you know, it's simply a ledger, fictional currency, money of account. It's not actual physical money, nor is it physical Federal Reserve notes or cash or anything like that. It's strictly about banks trading with banks and doing electronic communication settlements.
And then I guess that would also correspond, because what we were talking about earlier is that, is there a significant correlation between the expansion of the overall money supply, if we were able to quantify it, and global economic growth? And I guess that would make a lot of sense, because you would assume that the global economy grew massively from the 1950s to 1980.
Yes. It was just overdone during that period of 65 to 82, where there was just too much money, but there was still a lot of nominal growth. And once it kind of settled down into the 1980s and 90s, it was, you know, we had massive expansion all over the world. You had China rising from, you know, backwards subsistent agrarian economy into powerhouse. It wasn't just China. It was all around the world. You know, the Asian tigers of the 90s. Yeah. Legitimate growth, legitimate money to finance it.
Okay. So that makes a lot of sense. So one of the conclusions that we're going to keep going here, but I'd like to get your opinion on this. One of the conclusions that I came to in the video is that the 2020s, if we have the same system we have now, will most likely look like the 1940s. And if the bond market right now is telling us,
that's kind of the implication, right? Because if we look at the bond market, including all these other attachments to it, like Eurodollar futures, right now, just in economic terms, the bond market's verdict about the 2020s is that somehow it's going to be worse than 2010s. And the 2010s were not a very good time.
And again, guys, what we're talking about now specifically isn't necessarily what prices are going to do at the grocery store, but it's about global economic activity. We've got to compartmentalize those things. So what the bond market is telling us now, or this euro dollar futures curve, is that global economic activity in the 2020s will be worse than it was in the 2010s.
Right. And unless something changes between now and then, and the market is discounting that possibility and saying, we don't see anything that's going to change, at least nothing on the radar here. So we're looking at potentially lower growth, lower inflation for this decade.
One of the conclusions, so I tried in the video, I tried to compartmentalize, you know, what this meant for your finances and what the bond market is telling you about your personal freedom. And I said, you know, maybe for the last 6 months, the bond market and the gold market, I threw that in there because that hasn't gone up. Maybe it's been telling us that we'll not only get slower economic activity or less economic activity globally, but maybe it's also telling you that that's going to be a result of future lockdowns. So maybe the bond market was predicting the lockdowns that we're now seeing in Australia and in Europe.
Yeah, I mean, those are predictable too now. I mean, we've got an established pattern. That may be part of the fears about growth and inflation, that governments are going to overreact every time and say, let's put the brakes on everything. And even if it's not a universal uniform lockdown, even if it's just a mild, hey, we're gonna put on some travel restrictions, that's a restraint on growth. And it's a restraint on growth that we just cannot afford. We need everything to go perfectly.
Yeah.
And I think that's what the bond market is saying, is that, you know, there's just too many risks, including political risks, including pandemic risks, that we just can't price this rosy, happy, or even inflationary future. It's just not in the cards.
Yeah, see, that's a good point. I think we need to kind of zoom out as market participants and think about in 2019, Jeff, if I would have said to you, what would happen to the Austrian economy if the government locked their citizens in their house for an entire month, let alone 6 months? You would have said that would absolutely be devastating. I mean, anyone would say, not even, you know, a third grader would have said that. But
yeah, I think now we said it was a zero possibility too, right? Not only would it be devastating, there's no way that's going to happen.
Yeah, exactly. But now we talk about that and it's like, yeah, whatever. Another month of lockdown, no big deal. We don't understand that that still has just as damaging a consequence to the economy as it would have in 2019 when we were less acclimated to that.
And it's not just specific, you know, preventing activity. It's also psychological. It takes an enormous toll on risk taking,
right.
Which in a capitalist system, free market system, or nominally free market system, risk taking is absolutely important. It's essential to economic growth, sustained economic growth. We need supply side. We need all of these things. And these things continue to pile up. We've got a bad economic conditions. We've got overreactive governments. We've got a pandemic that doesn't seem to ever want to end. And it's just, it's a recipe for negativity and badness.
And as in terms of economic activity, I really want to try to encourage people to think along those lines. So that said, Jeff, let's go down and maybe further explain with some visuals what we've been talking about. I don't know if you can see this, but I've got your first chart up here of the euro dollar futures curve. So is this, let's see here, what is this showing us specifically?
This goes back to the last time the curve inverted, which was in 2018. And if you remember 2018, just briefly, it sounded a lot like today because Jay Powell was hawkish. The Fed was going to raise rates. Inflation was going to get out of control. The labor market was tight. All of those things that we hear about today, they were there then. We didn't have the CPI up in the stratosphere like we do now, but it was moving higher, and it was getting to the point where people were thinking it's going to become a major problem, which is why the Fed was going to start raising rates in an accelerated fashion. The market during 2018, however, was very different, not just Eurodollar futures, but across the bond market. It was expressing doubts as to this case. Skepticism was priced into these curves. So you look at the euro dollar futures curve here, it starts out relatively flat, but upward sloping in 2017. And then we get globally synchronized growth and everybody buys into inflation. The Fed starts really hiking rates and the curve starts to move up nominally. And you can see the whites and the reds, that you see that steepness in the front part of the curve, which is the market getting used to this hawkish stance in the Fed, you know, this hike, these rate hikes that Jay Powell is going to be able to do, or at least the ones that he says he's going to be able to do. But over through the first half of 2018, despite these proclamations about inflation and globally synchronized growth, you start to see the flatness develop in the greens and blues in the further out part of the curve, which is these, again, acting like two different curves coming together, where the market is sort of, you know, expressing, yes, Jay Powell says he's going to hike rates and he probably will get away with it for a while. But after some time, we're seeing a lot of negatives here pile up, a lot of really bad deflationary signs in the monetary system that are likely to cause some kind of problem at some point. And then we get to May 29th, 2018, which is a huge day for collateral. In terms of U.S. Treasury prices, they skyrocketed on a single day, which is an indication that the collateral system had buckled, which is a massive.
That was repo is what you're talking about, the repo blow up.
Yeah, it was, you know, collateral's always in short supply anyway. And then suddenly it became in such short supply, and not just in the U.S., globally. You know, German bonds skyrocketed more than U.S. Treasuries had. So it was indicative of a mad scramble for collateral, which is a highly deflationary signal, because if we go from collateral scarcity to outright collateral shortage, that means the bucks really stopped flowing. So that was the market in May of 2018 saying there's a collateral problem that we need to pay attention to as well.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was referring to September 2019.
Yeah, you're further down the road, which these things are all related anyway.
Yeah.
So May of 2018, we see a collateral blow up in the Treasury market. It wasn't as big as September 2019's repo rumble, but it was at least a solid sign of another deflationary risk that, of course, the Fed and the mainstream media just ignored, but the market didn't. And then 2 weeks after that, you know, a little bit over 2 weeks after that, we see this euro dollar curve invert for the first time in the greens and in the blues, which was the market saying, yes, Jay, it's steep up front. Jay Powell's going to continue hiking rates because he can get away with it for some time. But now we're starting to price substantial, significant doubts as to what is the future really going to look like in the intermediate term. And what the market was saying with that inversion is that we really expect something is going to happen, that we don't know what it is, and we don't know when it's going to happen, but something, you know, all of these negative potentials and risks are piling up, so that we're thinking something is going to happen and that Jay Powell's rate hikes are going to stop. And we're going to increasingly price the probability that he's going to actually have to turn around and start cutting rates at some point. Now, This initial aversion, June of 2018, not only did it cut against the narrative, but there's really no specifics in it. It's just the market starting to get a feel that these negative deflationary, the stuff you can't see in the shadows, it's starting to really go wrong. And the chances of something popping in the real, you know, the monetary system becomes a real problem for the real economy, that it's going to force lower interest rates, not higher interest rates. And as we said at the beginning, as you pointed out, George, we want to see an upward sloping curve because that means everything's good and normal. Now we have not just a bent curve and a flat curve, we have an upside down curve, which is the market really distorting based on these negative perceptions beyond the near term. So it was it was a general vibe that these negative things, these, you know, collateral, rising dollar, you know, dollar funding, all of these problems, potential problems in these the offshore marketplaces were going to interrupt the upward trend, the recovery, the inflation before it ever really got going.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Do you think that's what's going on with gold?
That's part of it. I think that gold is absolutely involved in the collateral. As we've seen historically, when repo collateral gets really tight and participants in the market get really short of collateral, gold will get used as sort of a last resort measure, and it's negative for the gold price usually when those things happen. So it's kind of counterintuitive why that would be, but through the mechanics of repo and collateral, that's usually what happens. So that could be what's going on if we get to a real collateral crunch or a little real collateral shortage, that, you know, in the short run, gold tends to drop, even though it might be, you know, over the intermediate run, becomes volatile, and maybe it's fine over the long run.
Yeah. I mean, when I sit there and look at the bond market, the long end there, even without the insight of this euro dollar future curve, and I look at the dollar on the DXY, and then I look at the price of gold, I say, boy, it's sure, you know, I don't know what's going to happen to consumer prices. I think they could still even continue to go up, maybe at a slower rate, but it sure is telling me that economic activity globally is going to be a lot lower going into 2022 than we think it's going to be, or at least the Fed thinks it's going to be.
No, and I think that's what the inversion is here. The version that we saw this week is a carbon copy of 2018. It's again, it's steep in the whites and the reds. So the market is saying Jay Powell's current hawkishness in 2021 and 2022, they're probably going to taper. They may even get to some rate hikes. But before too long, now we get into the greens and the blues, the curve is saying something is likely to go wrong, whether it's, you know, a deflationary spasm, whether it's just economic growth disappoints too much that it creates problems, whatever it is, we don't really know right now. We don't know when it's going to happen, but we have this really, really bad feeling that something is more likely to go wrong than everything is to go right. And that's why we have this inversion. And it's a really, to me, that's why I wrote the title, which was, this is a big one to me. When you see inversion in a money curve like Eurodollar futures, because it's such a huge, deep, liquid market, an inversion is such, you know, it's an upset to the natural order. It takes a lot of bad vibes to get this curve to invert. It takes a lot of even more bad vibes for it to stay inverted. And by the way, we're in day three of inversion. And over just the 3 days, I'm actually a little bit surprised at how much the inversion has deepened and spread. It's not just in the narrow part that it was on December 1st. It's actually up as far as, I think, the March 2024 contracts now, all the way down to the March 2026 contracts. So we're talking definitely greens and definitely the blues, where the market is saying, again, we don't know what, but the chances are something is going to go wrong. And as you pointed out, economic activity is going to get hammered by something, likely to get hammered by something, probably deflationary money, rising costs, that kind of a thing. That's more likely than things are going to continue to go right. And Jay Powell's going to be able to hike rates as long as he wants to.
Yeah, people have to understand how unnatural it is. I mean, I think just putting it into a context that everyone can understand, to say that you're lending your buddy $1,000. Well, if you lend him that $1,000 over 30 years, is the interest rate you charge going to be higher or lower than if you were giving him a loan for 3 months? Well, obviously it would be way higher because you're taking so much more risk by allowing him to use that money for 30 years. So that's the natural way of the natural price of money, I should say. And so when you see the opposite, to where you're charging him more for interest for 3 months than you are for 30 years on an annual basis, you can see how that should not happen.
Yeah, inversion is a complete upset to the natural order. And it should not happen. It does happen. And the reason we associate it with only bad outcomes is because inversion only means bad outcomes. There really isn't anything good here.
How accurate has it been historically, Jeff?
Yeah, that's the real bad part here is, unfortunately, the Eurodollar futures curve, as I said in the early part of the article, is among the most reliable early warning indicators we have. Yeah. I'll give you an example, not just 2018, 2006. December of 2006, Eurodollar futures inverted in exactly the same way. Outside the whites and the reds, into the blues and the greens. Everybody ignored it. Subprime was contained. But the Eurodollar futures curve, 2 years before Lehman Brothers had said, almost 2 years before Lehman Brothers had said, this is going to be a big problem. This is going to be something we need to pay attention to. This inversion means things are getting serious. And that's why I said this is a big deal, because when you see Eurodollar futures and curve inverted, because it's priced on 3 month LIBOR, it's a fundamental piece of the global monetary puzzle. It is something you'd want to pay attention to and understand what's really going on, because not only is it, you know, a big, deep, sophisticated market, it has been reliable. Probably because it is a big, deep, sophisticated market. You know, it is telling us, again, from the inside, what is being perceived about the monetary system, and therefore the prospects or the implications of today playing out tomorrow and, you know, over the intermediate future.
When we had the last inversion in the twos and the tens, was that at the end of 2018 or the beginning of 2019?
That was in August of 2019. So, you know, just before that repo mess that you talked about before, okay, the bond market was saying, we're in a mess here. We're in a real mess here.
Yes. Okay. So then what was the euro dollar future curve telling us at that time?
By that time, the
same thing?
If we roll forward from where we were in the middle of 2018, we got the little tiny bit of inversion, which is itself a huge signal, like where we are today. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, for the next couple of months of 2018, you never really got more than a little bit inverted, but that in and of itself was a negative warning sign. It meant that the inversion was sticking around, which you never want to see. But then you get to November of 2018, and then the curve just collapsed.
2018,
long before 2019. The Eurodollar curve not just inverted a little bit in the greens and the blues, it was inverted a hell of a lot, not just greens and blues, but also the whites and the reds. So now we see the front part of the curve go from steep upward sloping to steep downward sloping. By early January 4th of 2019, the Eurodollar futures curve from top to about, you know, into the blues was 30 basis points inverted, which is, that's like middle 2007 inverted. That's really, something's really going wrong here. So the curve inverted long before we got to the trouble in the rest of 2018. And it was coincident to a huge downdraft in interest rates, bond yields all over the world, coincident to, you know, some inversion in other parts of the yield curve, and a lot of economic growth really tailing off all over the world.
And then you had repo.
On top of everything.
Yeah, then you had repo then in November of 2019. And then you had the we'll call it the Cerveza sickness. I mean,
yes.
I don't know if it was predicting that, but that would be
No, and that's incredible. The thing, you know, when you step back and look at this, at the Eurodollar curve, and you take it literally, it looks like in June of 2018, it was predicting COVID, because it was saying, you know, the greens and the blues were the middle of 2020. The market was saying, if you take them literally, the contracts seem to be saying that the market was seeing a problem in the middle of 2020. How the hell did they know about COVID back in 2018? And that's why I said you can't take the curves literally. There's these technical factors where you have to look at the greens and the blues and say, well, it's not saying the market is expecting problems in 2020. It's expecting problems at some point in the future.
But at least it's telling you that the economy itself, the global economy, was structurally unsound going into COVID. So it wasn't, you know, a lot of the talking heads on CNBC like to make you think that
everything was great. Kind
of, yeah, that everything was fantastic until we just got this random event out of right field, and that just crushed the global economy. And you're like, no. It was broken.
No, these curves said, as you just said, there was lots of structural weaknesses in the real economy, and even more so, lots of susceptibility in the monetary system that made it prone to things like September 2019 repo or these knee-jerk hiccups and spasms that should never happen. They shouldn't be able to happen. And the market, these markets are telling you that these things are primed to happen. These are things that are likely to happen. They're so likely to happen. Look at the inverted curve. It's saying there's bad stuff that you don't see that never gets reported that we can see because we're in the system. We're in these marketplaces. We're in these offshore dollar markets. Right. And we're telling you by what we're doing in these markets, what we're hedging and how we're pricing things, what we actually think is going on and what we think is likely to happen as a consequence of all of these problems that exist. And they exist independent of the Fed's bank reserves. I gotta point that out every time. Doesn't matter how much the Fed's bank reserves are. They are completely irrelevant here because, as we see, there's trillions upon trillions. And all year we've heard about too much money and all this nonsense. Yet here we have all of these curves that are reliable, time-tested, saying, there's too much deflationary risk. In fact, there's so much deflationary risk right now. This curve is inverted. And look at the yield curve. The yield curve is flattening out like, you know, I don't remember the curve ever flattening out, especially in the 5-year tenure region, this fast, this quickly.
Now you're talking about the bond market.
The treasury curve. It's just amazing how much negative signals there are that people just want to ignore or dismiss or something.
I just want to insert there for clarity. We can use the term a decrease in economic activity when you say deflation.
Yeah, because I don't.
I think we possibly could see consumer prices still go up at a slower rate, but yet the economic activity just collapses.
I think, though, the market is saying that consumer prices are not going to be going up for much longer. And we're already seeing, I think, that the leading edge of that actual outright deflation in certain commodities, especially the knee-jerk reaction in oil over the last couple of days, which is indicative of very serious concerns about the demand side, again, economic activity, and what that will do to just even, you know, the supply squeeze and the situation in commodities themselves, which are obviously very susceptible to questions about demand.
Yeah.
So I think it's really a comprehensive picture, top to bottom, where it's not just the yield curve, where it's not just Eurodollar futures, it's all of these things that are very consistently saying the risks are stacked against Jay Powell's, you know, more inflationary or happy, rosy recovery type of future. In my language, the way I characterize it, that's deflationary, which people hate using that term because, hey, the CPI is 6.2%. How can you say it's deflationary?
Yeah, that's why I'm just trying to kind of compartmentalize for the viewer. So just again, guys, to reiterate, the way I think about this, I just try to focus on economic activity and then try to answer the question of consumer price increases or consumer price disinflation, which is still, you got a little bit of inflation, but it's just going down. You know, we don't see it at 6.2. We see it at, let's say, 3.3, something like that.
You said earlier, it's global too. So might see, like what you're saying, you might see disinflation in the US where consumer price increases decelerate, though it never turn negative, but it'll be outright deflation in places like Europe or Japan.
Yep.
So there will be deflation somewhere around the world, even if we don't see it in America, it does tend to be actually deflationary, which
great point,
which is one reason why I use the term. The other reason is just to distinguish from the inflation narrative versus something else. So, you're right to, we need to clarify what we're talking about, be specific. And I think that's probably the best way to say it. You're focusing on economic activity in terms of prices. It may not be, our experience might not be the same as in somebody else's around the world, but in general, it is deflationary.
Yep. Got it. Okay. And yet, I wanted to get to some callers. We'll get to some callers in just a moment here, Jeff. We got about 1,500 people on the live stream, so people are really enjoying your input here. But I read an article from the IMF talking about emerging markets and the trouble that they're going to have servicing their debt. So is this curve potentially even warning us that there could be some defaults in the dollar-denominated debt of some of these emerging market countries or corporations within those countries?
Yeah, see, again, we don't know exactly what, specifically the Eurodollar futures curve is worried about.
Yeah.
But that certainly could be a big one, couldn't it? Because you got to think, emerging markets especially, for the last couple of years, it's been really bad in those places. And in some ways, the supply shock and the consumer prices and commodity prices have masked substantial economic weakness and lack of recovery. Right. In some of those places.
And so many of those are commodity producers. I just want to.
Yeah, we haven't really reconciled their debt loads, which were already extreme. And all that played a role in what happened in 2018, 2019, too, because a lot of that junk debt was used as the basis of the pyramid and the collateral scheme, which, that never really got worked out either. And so in a lot of ways, some of the stuff that was left over from 2019 may come back to really bite the system in 2022, especially if the recovery or the rebound becomes weaker or becomes a downturn into next year globally. And we have, another deflationary shock through collateral collateral squeeze globally. That might be what the Eurodollar futures curve is pricing right now. We don't know because, you can't call them up and ask them. You don't really know what's going on in the system. What it's saying is that, again, there is something bothering the market. And what you just said, George, emerging market debt could definitely be one of those things that's really at the top of the list of things that would bother the market such that it would invert the curve.
Right. What does, and I'll ask one more question here, then we'll get to the callers, I promise. What would that mean, or what would the takeaways be for the typical equities investor and the bond investor? Because the way I'm thinking about this, so equities, I think that would be negative, a lot of potential down or headwind for the stock market. But then
does the stock market have headwinds?
If that's even
I'm
a thing.
Sure,
anymore.
It does.
Yeah, such an antiquated idea, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, boomer.
Fundamentals and stocks don't go together very well.
Yeah. Right. But then the bond market, because it's interesting, if we go through a 1940s, if you held that bond to maturity, you're losing an incredible amount of purchasing power, while at the same time, you might have some capital appreciation on the actual price of the bond. So how does a bond investor reconcile that?
Well, what the bond market is really saying is you're right, we're losing money, but this is the least worst option. We'd rather hold safe and liquid instruments because the alternative is to hold illiquid, risky stuff, which we think is going to turn out even worse.
Yep.
So what kind of awful situation is that where large financial institutions all over the world willingly choose what will probably lose
negative,
them money
negative
in real,
real
terms
yield. Yeah.
Because they don't like any of the other alternatives. So again, it's another way to say the same things that we've been saying, but put in this different terms, which is things are not going to be very well. Things are not projected to go very well because, bond prices are going up, not because the Fed's buying them, but because the market is saying, we don't like the look of the situation, and the badness or the bad vibe of the current situation seems to be getting worse all the time, that it's now distorting curves in an open and outright fashion that everybody can see. So, how bad are things potentially going to be in the intermediate future?
Yeah. Okay. That I've got it. I'm crystal clear now. That was awesome. So now let's go to a caller. Sir, you're on with Jeff Snyder. What is your name?
My name?
Yes.
That's me? Oh,
yes.
What an honor. Thank you very much. I'm a huge fan from you guys from Brazil. And I just want to ask if you know about something about Brazil or the situation we are here.
Yeah, Jeff, because I think you and Emil just interviewed a gal that's a pro from Brazil. Is that correct? Maybe a few months ago?
Yeah, a few months ago, we had, I forget her name now, sorry about that, but from George Friedman's office. And yes, she had a lot of very interesting political, geopolitical viewpoints about South America in general and Brazil in particular.
Yeah.
And, Brazil's in a really tough spot. Brazil's in, it's a downstream resource-oriented economy that in a lot of ways depends upon economic growth through China and Asia more generally, more broadly, yes, that may not be there because the Chinese are saying, we've got a dollar problem. We know the world has a dollar problem. We don't see any economic recovery on the in the foreseeable future. So how does that impact Brazil? And I can't imagine it impacts Brazil in any positive way whatsoever. Yeah. On top of the local issues, which, you know, the pandemic and pandemic related policies are only going to complicate what is a potentially negative situation anyway.
Yeah. And I read today their debt to GDP just went over 100%. And their expenses are, I think they're running a deficit at, to the tune of about 25% of GDP.
Yes. But we have our international reserves in about $370 billion that pays all the foreign debt we have. But
no, see, that's the thing, that there's a misconception about what foreign reserves are and what they represent.
Yes.
And as you know, from Brazil has had this $300 billion pile of foreign reserves for many years.
Yes.
It sure didn't offer it much insurance in 2013, 14, and 15 when the real collapsed, which was based on dollar shortage that the Brazilian economy or the Brazilian officials did very little about. The Brazilians like to engage in contingent liabilities, these contingent swaps with local banks through the Cupom Cambial. It doesn't really do much other than it allows the media to print nice stories about how the central bank has all of these tools available, yet the outcomes never match what the promises are, which usually leaves these emerging market economies independently of, you know, their continued dollar problems. So, you know, it sounds like reserves are supposed to be insurance against dollar shortages, but it never works out that way. In fact, what the bigger the dollar pile you have, the bigger the dollar reserves in each of these countries. That just means you have a bigger potential dollar problem because of the when things were going well, it allowed you to accumulate reserves, and then the reserves don't really help you. And if the dollar system reverses, that just means you got a big problem.
Yeah, right. We pay every year about $50 billion just to maintain this money in the banks or IMF and everything.
Yeah, the significant outflows means you're basically hooked on dollars.
Yes, that's kind of the point. And I hear George and you always talking about the crisis of the bonds and treasuries. And I think if we have something worse happening to the dollar, because you talk about the euro dollar too, because it's unpayable. I think it's going to be very bad to the whole world.
Yeah, but dollar goes up. Yeah, I mean, the dollar were to spike to 110, 120 on the DXY, that's real bad for especially areas like Brazil.
Yeah, yes. Dollar goes up is bad for everybody, including people in the U.S.
Yeah.
And the other way too, if the dollar goes busted, I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, but that's a lot better for Brazil because then all that dollar-denominated debt out there, it wouldn't be as much of a burden. And that would be very, very beneficial for places like Turkey, Brazil, Argentina, etc.
Okay.
All right, nice. Sir, I appreciate the call.
Thank you very much. I was very pleased. I'm a big fan. Thank you very much.
All right, enjoy your day. All right, Josh, we got someone else.
Hey, George, how's it going?
I'm doing well. What is your name, caller?
My name's Matthew. Matthew Lowe.
Matthew, how's it awesome. Going? You're on with Jeff Snyder. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I do. Hey, Jeff. Oh, I think I have a solution to all this madness, too.
Great.
We need to end the Fed. No, I mean, the takeaway, I was just digesting all that. I mean, we've got a bunch of crazy central planners that are, you know, stacking a house of cards on a spinning top and basically ruining the economy for the rest of us. But my question, I've got two questions. One about bonds. So let's say the treasury rate, let's say whether they raise it to fight inflation or whatever, or it goes up on its own.
You mean the Fed funds rate?
Yes. Okay. Or, well, just the rate on treasury bonds in general. If that goes up to, let's say, 5%, and we know that we're $30 trillion in debt, or whatever, and there's no way that we can pay that. Is that going to be inflationary because we're going to just have to go further in debt to pay the, you know, the interest on those reserves? I mean, if we go down that road, I don't even know if we can go down that road, but would that be an inflationary event? Paying, because every year we're going to go more and more to debt, pay out that interest, and then keep going down that rabbit hole.
Are you talking?
What do you think, Jeff?
Yeah, I mean, if that happened, it would be, but I don't think that's ever going to happen.
you think that we're
no,
we're
I don't think bond yields are going to get higher at all, and I don't think it the Fed doesn't play any role in it. It's the market is saying we want safe liquid instruments at any price. So long as the market is willing to absorb safe and liquid instruments, unfortunately, governments are going to be able to take advantage of that by continuing to borrow money. That's the perverse incentive structure of a deflationary condition. It's that the market wants safe and liquid because there isn't money in the economy. There isn't money in the Eurodollar system. So it wants to own only safe and liquid instruments, which is what governments happen to provide. And so they're essentially taking a free ride on this deflationary condition. And what the market is saying is that this is not forecast to change anytime soon. So unfortunately and horribly, the U.S. government in particular, which is the worst offender, is probably going to get away with this for quite a long period of time more. And the interest rates are not going to rise because the market is not recognizing credit risks. The market is more prioritizing the safe and liquid characteristics, thus, you know, the liquidity issues and the liquidity risks in these marketplaces rather than what it should be doing, which is saying like what you're laying out, which is recoiling at the ridiculous, absurd amounts of debt and borrowing and saying, I don't want to buy treasuries anymore. But that's not happening. It's the opposite is happening. The market is saying we want treasuries, even though governments are broke and going broker by the day, because our problems today are more about lack of liquidity in the system than they are about whether or not the U.S. government can pay its bills. And it's, believe me, it's upside down. It's horrible. It's awful. It's something that, you know, I don't agree with. But the reality of the situation is that interest bond yields are not likely to go up because the market doesn't like the fiscal deficits of the, not just the U.S. government, but governments around the world.
Yeah, it's a feedback loop too, because that allows the governments to profligate spend to a greater degree, which distorts the economy to a greater degree. Which makes increased demand for those bonds because there's nothing else out there.
Yeah, it's a vicious cycle. I mean, look at Japan. The more the government gets involved, the less it's going to positively impact the economy, which means more deflation. And more deflation means, you know, more demand for safe and liquid instruments, which the government is only too happy to provide. Yeah. And it's just this awful perverse cycle.
We're just digging a deeper hole here.
Yeah.
But I mean,
and
you
it's
know, the
one
picture
that nobody knows how to get out of because they can't make sense of all these things because we're told, oh, government spending's inflationary. Government or the, you know, bond market hates you know, credit risk in the government bonds, and you can't connect all these dots to make a coherent picture to say what's really going on here is just simple textbook deflationary money.
And I, you and I spoke, Jeff, after the Rebel Capitalist Conference, and you explained that, you know, it looks like we're headed down Japan, and I got really depressed after that. You're like, oh, we got 30 years of a bleak future ahead of us. I'm like, I'm hoping someday sanity will, you know. Okay, so my second question is, you know that you're saying the banks aren't lending, there's no economic activity, but one area where they are lending a lot is in margin debt, right? I mean, we're at record levels. They're lending, obviously, to people. I could go get a line of credit for, I don't know, $1 million, whatever, to buy on Robinhood.
And so,
I could leverage myself up 10 million times. So is that inflationary in any way?
No, that's actually, again, deflationary because the banks are saying that they view the safest alternative to actually lending in the real economy and productive projects is financial stuff. That's unproductive. That's,
it's
the opposite of what we want banks to do.
I don't want to cut you off there, but again, guys, just view this through the lens of economic activity in the
real
economy.
Yeah, real economy, lending in the real economy is productive for real economic activity sustained into the future. If we're, companies buying back their shares by borrowing debt in the bond market, for example, that's deflationary too, because they should be investing in their own capacities rather than messing around in, you know, the repurchases of their own equities. That's not inflationary because it's just money chasing its own tail. Money that isn't being used productively.
Yeah, so the banks are looking at the real economy and they're saying it's so bad out there. There's so little economic growth, or there's such a decline in economic activity that instead of lending to a business to grow their business and create more goods and services, hire more workers, we would rather give you $100 million to buy Dogecoin. That's really what we're talking about here.
I mean, I could be the richest man in the world if I could borrow $250 billion and invest it into my own company. It seems like a pretty good deal. But yeah, I don't know.
They're worried about demand. They're worried about your customers. I mean, they're worried about all these things that go into economic activity.
Yeah. So, I mean, and George, I watched your video this, you know, of the time frame. I mean, it seems like things are almost going really fast. You know, I'm worried that you were saying this could look like the 40s over the 20s. I mean, it might look like the 40s and the 50s in the next couple of years. You know,
yeah, it does seem like it's a more compressed time frame for sure. I mean, I hope it's not, because it gives us more time to figure out a soft landing,
plan B,
fourth turning, you know, when I was talking about that on the video, because that ends badly. So hopefully we've got some time to figure out a solution for that.
Well, thanks for all your insight, guys. I mean, we really appreciate it, trying to navigate through, all this insanity. And, Jeff, are you going to be there in Houston this year? I forgot if you're on the lineup.
He's speaking to our mastermind group, but we're going to get him back in the summer in Miami if he's free for that.
All right. Well, I look forward to talking to you again next time, and you as well, George. And thanks again, guys, for all your great information. Appreciate it.
Awesome. Welcome. Thank you for the call. All right. Well, Jeff, I've kept you over an hour, buddy. We've got almost 1,650 people on live. So you got time for another call?
Yeah, let's keep going. I mean, the more we talk about this stuff, the better.
Yeah. All right. Hello, listener. What is your name?
Justin. How you doing?
Justin, doing well. You're on with Jeff Snyder.
Awesome. I went to Rebel Capitalist down in Miami. Appreciate you guys both. It's really hard to understand anything Jeff says, so I appreciate you trying to translate.
Common complaint. I get that all the time. I wish I could.
It's like you got a whole picture of everything that's going on, and you point out these little things and these little things, and then I just lose you. But appreciate you, George. So my question is, you know, with what you're seeing, Jeff, what are you doing with your own money in order to combat or, you know, how are you predicting the future? What are you doing with your own money in order for us to try to do the same?
Or at least learn
and be successful. Yes.
Yeah. I'm being very careful.
So basically, it's return of capital instead of maybe focusing on capital appreciation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's different ways that you can, I mean, everything is an opportunity. And if you're willing to take risk, even a deflationary marketplace would be an opportunity to take risk and make a lot of money on the downswing. Or you could just be, hey, I know things might get bad and I'll just wait for things to happen. And when things settle out, we find some kind of a bottom, maybe that's a good time to put capital in. It's really about what you think you want to do, what risks you want to take, because if you're relatively certain that we have a deflationary cycle in front of us, it's not just, you know, you don't just have to sit on the sidelines getting nothing. You can participate and take risky activities. It's a little bit more difficult and maybe counterintuitive at times, but there are ways to do things.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, that's all I had. I appreciate you guys both.
Okay. Great. Thank you for the call. Okay. There we go. All right. Well, we'll leave it at that, Josh. Jeff, thanks a lot for your time. That was just an incredible conversation. I just thoroughly enjoyed that.
Oh, it's my pleasure, George. Always happy to talk.
Yeah. So for the viewers who want to find out more about what you do and your show with Emil, where you guys talk about this stuff all the time, where can they go?
Yeah. Our show is called Eurodollar University. So obviously we're talking about Eurodollar futures and the Eurodollar futures curve. Yeah. My co-host, Emil Kalinowski, who is a character himself. You know, so we have a lot of fun talking about these things. As Justin said, most people don't pay attention much to what I say. They're more paying attention to what Emil says, because he's very good about disseminating, communicating in ways that I'm not. So it's on YouTube, podcasts, you know, Apple, iTunes, whatever that stuff is. You can find Eurodollar University out there somewhere. And I post, you know, a couple times a day about certain things, economy, marketplaces, at my company's blog at alhambrapartners.com. So if you're interested in reading rather than hearing me talk, which is I understand completely, you can go there.
And what do you do for Real Clear Markets? Is that somewhere that just takes your blog post and
No, I actually produced a long form essay every week. So it's a regular Friday column where I try to go into real deep dives about some of these things. Just today, it was about Eurodollar futures, the reds, the whites, the blues, and the greens. And was the market predicting COVID 2 years ahead of time? And how do we interpret the curve? And so, you know, I'm there every Friday with, again, a long form essay trying to take a really deep look at what's going on in some of these shadow money places.
All right, viewers, we'll leave it there. I want to encourage you to always stand up and fight for freedom, for liberty, free market capitalism, and we'll see you on the next video.